Prudent Money with Bob Brooks is sponsored by the Prudent Money Foundation on 91.3.
Well, are we starting to see a shift in college borrowing? Today we're going to take a look. Stay tuned for Prudent Money. Good afternoon and welcome to the Prudent Money Radio Show. I'm your host, Bob Brooks. Thank you so much for joining me today. You know I do appreciate it. Listen, a recent report showed some changes in student loan borrowing. College admissions and college funding expert John Upalo is here to weigh in. John, now let's discuss an article that recently came out concerning undergraduate borrowing. A U.S. report shows undergraduate borrowing was down in 2015-16 from 4 years earlier across nearly all types of institutions. Meanwhile, the proportion of students receiving grant funding rose. You know, talk about what all that means.
Well, Bob, good afternoon. And what it means, frankly, is that those folks who have been on the bandwagon that all student loan debt is bad and people are overborrowing, they don't have such great things to talk about. But for those of us who like to realize that the student loans can help, and when students use that with the right mix of grant funding, it can be an absolutely wonderful way to finance an education. But to get to this point about this study, it's really very, very encouraging because, again, loans need to be repaid. Grants do not need to be repaid. So we call the grant money the free money and the good money. The fact that those students are receiving more of that than they did in the previous four-year period is a good thing. And also, the fact that student loans are down over that period is great. And I saw some very recent statistics, actually, that say that in that next following year, so from the year of 2016-17, looking back 1 year, federal loans are down yet again year over year, and institutional grant aid is up pretty considerably. So the trends look to be quite favorable at the moment.
You know, so it seems like we've kind of hit an inflection point to where all the things that we've talked about over the last year, you know, where you got to get a game plan, you have to take advantage of the different things, you have to be intentional about financing a college education. It just seems like people are really starting to go that direction.
I agree, Bob, and you and I are sort of cautiously optimistic and definitely optimists on this point, that if people have a plan, they think it out well before that financial aid award letter arrives and it's time to pay that first bill. If they start freshman year and sophomore year, they begin to think about how much college will cost and how they will pay for it in advance with a plan, they're going to be in a much better position. And like you, I'm hopeful that this recent data is telling us that this is happening across the country. It's a terrific trend.
Now, that report also said, and I thought this was pretty interesting, that student loan borrowing was down, but the amount borrowed was up. So what does that say about the trend of student loan borrowing?
Well, I think one thing it says is you can't draw conclusions from one data point.
Apparently.
We know that. But I think your question's the right one. You know, how does that happen? And I think when you dig into some of the numbers, some of those trends will show that in specific areas. For instance, although the number of students who took loans to attend for-profit schools dramatically dropped, the amount that each one of those students who did borrow went up pretty significantly. You and I have scratched our heads about this, and I know the data analysts in Washington are also scratching their heads. So I think for now we need to be happy that the trend's the right way. And then I think your point is let's figure out if this is a systemic issue that's actually trending very favorably. My sense is that sometimes those folks who come out of the process, meaning they didn't borrow unnecessarily, they may have been borrowing lower amounts so that when the average comes with a smaller base to make that division, it looks like those loan amounts have gone up. Again, these are numbers and averages, so it's hard to draw substantive conclusions from one or two data points.
You know, one of the things the report talked about, and you know, they mentioned the 2 and 4 year for-profit programs. You mentioned for-profit a second ago. Now, I would assume that when you say for-profits, you're talking about some of the bigger universities, but you correct me if I'm wrong on that, but if they talk about some of the biggest drops in the proportion of students borrowing, you know, what do you attribute to that?
Well, the for-profit category has gone through a significant amount of change and disruption over the last 5 years or so. And I think when you look across that spectrum of schools that fell into the for-profit category, there are some really terrific schools, but there are also a number, and unfortunately not a small number, of those that were not really providing the education for the amount of money they were charging. Their dropout rates were extraordinarily high. Their loan percentage rates were extraordinarily high. Their default rates were extraordinarily high. So the Obama administration really took this on, and they went they were kind of on a mission to try to close down many of those schools that they thought were not providing the value for an education. And Secretary DeVos, our new education secretary now with the Trump administration for a little over a year, has looked at that as part of the overall Trump view that there may have been excessive regulation, that the pendulum had swung too far, and that they were starting to pick up some for-profit schools that are actually quite good. So there's an awful lot going on in that for-profit sector, but I think the right way to think about it is that there's been a big disruption, and oftentimes, you know, in economics, when a big disruption like this occurs, what's left is actually quite a good product. And I think that those for-profit schools that are still here providing services to schools have been through the ringer, and I'm willing to bet that they are significantly stronger, providing better value today for their students than the class did five or so years ago.
Now, I'm going to have to call you out on something you said, that you actually said that politicians over-regulated. I don't know that that could ever be the case.
Well,
let's fix it. Let's over-regulate it.
I understand your point. Exactly.
We'll talk about this. Let's go with the assumption, and hopefully it won't be an assumption as we go through and get more statistics down the road, that you're starting to see colleges lower the college overall cost of college education. And I would imagine, tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, you know, some of your major universities, I would imagine that most colleges don't want to be on the front end of this process. They don't want to be the pioneers, if you will, to go out there and start lowering costs. I mean, how are colleges going about that process?
Bob, you and I have talked in the past, and it's really important to remind everyone about the difference between the sticker price of the school and the net price. And the difference is the sticker price is when I Google or go to the school's website, there's a number there. And on average for 4 year private schools, that number is getting pretty close to $60,000. Mm. Some of them are over $70,000. But as we've talked about in the past, when you factor in all the financial aid, the grant awards, and all the rest of it, the price that really counts for every family is the net price, the price that they're going to pay for that particular education. And it's shocking to me the game that the schools have played. So although they increase their sticker price by a couple, or 3% or 4% or whatever it may be every year, they actually have a backdoor way, and they call it tuition discounting, of lowering the price. And so I hope you're sitting down when I'm telling you that almost 50% of the sticker price of for private four-year colleges was discounted for the class of 2015, 2016. So they may have had a sticker price of $60,000, but the price they were actually charging the average family was $30,000.
30?
To get into the weeds, the average discount rate was 48.6%. So if they were charging 60, almost half of that, about 30. So the question you asked is the right question. The answer, though, is really interesting because they have long been charging significantly less. But to your exact point, they don't want to be the ones raising their hand to say, you know what, the reality is we're going to charge $30,000 or $35,000 and we're not going to tuition discount. When you come to our school, we're going to be transparent about the price, and everybody's going to pay $30,000 or $35,000. So they paid this big game over a long period of time where they kept the sticker prices high. They continue to increase the sticker price. But when you look at this really fascinating chart, I'll be glad to send it to you. You can post it up on the Maven. There's this great chart that one of the organizations did that shows the tuition discount rates for first-time freshmen and for all undergraduates from 2004 to 2015-16. It started at 34% way back in 2004 and 48.6% in 2015-16. So you talk about doing a little digging and what you'll find, that's what you find.
So tell me this, how does that look? What's that look like? You've got, you enroll your child in college and you're expecting to pay $60,000 and you get a bill that's discounted. I mean, where do you get the warning that's coming?
No, well, and that's exactly the point when you and I have talked about it in the past. You say, you know, make this plan, save what you can, understand what all the opportunities are, but never, it's a huge mistake, never say I can't afford a particular school because you don't know what financial aid package they're going to provide to that student. So the reality is that something on the order of almost 90% of first-time freshmen receive some kind of institutional grant. And a grant is basically a tuition discount because they're saying, you know, the price is 60, but we're going to give you a grant of 5 or 20 or whatever it might be. So that's lowering your actual cost. Almost 90% of students in these private four-year schools are receiving some kind of institutional grant. And your very first point at the top of the show, you noted that grant aid is up. Institutional grant aid over the last 10-year period is actually up about 100%. It's now approaching almost $60 billion a year in free money that colleges are giving to students.
So you have a major university. They charge $60,000, that is the sticker price, to go per year. And they disguise these reductions in cost as in the form of financial aid packages with grants. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's right.
That's what I'm hearing you say. So if you've got,
right.
But obviously that percentage is different per student, I would assume.
Absolutely.
And so what gives my kid a 48% reduction versus the guy, child that's across the dorm room hall only got 10? What's the difference between the two?
Well, it could be, and this is where we talked in the past about merit aid packages. You know, why do colleges provide merit aid? Sometimes they have, perhaps they'll have, I'm making this up, but to give you an idea, there may be a grant for first-time Latino students, or there may be a grant for some special category of student that particular student fits into. Or it may well be that the college, and I told you in the past this happened with my daughter, where she went from the Northeast to the cornfields of Indiana, and they, I believe, wanted to fill out their class for geographical diversity. They wanted some girls from the Northeast, so they gave her a nice merit scholarship. Again, you don't know what's in the colleges, the way the college is going to allocate that financial aid through the merit scholarship programs, but it's very active, and they use it for all kinds. And again, I can't say that, you know, your son who's a sophomore, when he gets it, he might come up on a school and, you know, there it is, and he has some particular attribute. Maybe he has a talent that the school is particularly looking for, and they're going to give him a merit aid package. He doesn't have to apply for it. He may not need to renew it. It might automatically renew. And it's part of the program that the colleges have set up of ways that they attract students. So it's a really we're getting to a really interesting topic here around the economics of how schools fill seats. But this idea of making sure that your listeners know that it's never a good idea to say we can't afford a particular school because you don't know what the school is looking for when they're trying to fill out their freshman class.
You know, you and I have had many conversations and done a lot of programs together, and I don't think that I ever connected the dots on that. And so let me ask you a couple of questions then. What happens what has to happen to get the maximum amount of financial aid or the maximum amount of a grant? Is there really anything that a parent can do for a child to get that to happen? Or is it just kind of it's given to you based on your resume or an application, or how does that work?
Yeah, so there are two things. Actually, there are many things that parents can do. But the first thing right from the beginning of high school is to encourage that student to have great work habits and do really well in school. So position themselves strongly to have when they, you know, again, they call it the package. When you package yourself in the form of a college application, make sure that these strengths come through. And, you know, things like having a great grade point average, having good test scores, being a leader, being involved on an activity or two, not 16 activities. They want to see some depth. They like to see some leadership, you know, something the student's passionate about. So I think that's the first thing. And then the second, it's really critical that families fill out the federal application for free student aid, the FAFSA. Free application for federal student aid is a formula that drives need-based grants that the federal government offers, state governments offer, and sometimes even the schools use this formula to dole out some of the need-based money. So they may, if they have the income of a certain level, may qualify automatically for a federal government grant, a Pell Grant, or another kind of grant. There may be some grants here in Texas that they would be eligible for. So everyone should fill out that FAFSA form. And that's for need-based aid. And then the other aid that we're talking about, this merit-based aid, again, how does this come through? Perhaps in an essay when a student's writing something, you know, specifically that intrigues them, during an interview potentially for a school. Oftentimes when college representatives go to college fairs, you know, they're not just there to see if everybody's dressed well. Their antenna's up. You know, some student comes by and says, boy, I've really been interested in your school, and, you know, I'm a trumpeter in the band, and I'd love to play in the marching band. You know, the officer from the school is going to realize that, oh, this student's, you know, the kind of student we may want. And you never know. That could lead to one of these merit scholarships to, you know, play in the band or work on the play or whatever it might be.
So does take a major university, for instance, and they're trying to reduce the cost on the back end of college education. Where is that literally money? And it may sound like a crazy question. Is this money that they literally lose, or do they get to pull it from someplace else?
Well, that is the $64,000 question, and it's a little of each. So universities with major endowments use that endowment money to fund many of these scholarships. Other universities that don't have those kinds of endowment see that come from their bottom line. And some financial aid officers that I talk to, particularly in schools that I say are sort of on the bubble, these are mid-sized private colleges. Sometimes, let's say with the mid-sized private colleges for a while, they have an economics around their net tuition revenue. That's the big for every single school. Net tuition revenue is how they judge their ability to perform. And they'll tell you on these schools that are really competing on the edge for students to try to fill that class, that if sometimes they offer more financial aid, it means they have to cut some resources or some programs. And we see that across the country as well. A Chronicle of Higher Education is one of the papers that I read for this kind of information. And there are articles in there pretty consistently that XYZ school is no longer going to offer a political science degree or maybe some flavor of another degree or Latin or whatever it might be, that they have to cut their program choices for students because they just can't afford to keep those professors employed. So it's a little bit of everything. And then, of course, you know, for the state universities, it's always difficult to try to get additional funding from the state legislatures for these programs. And their net tuition revenue may be down as well. And they try to supplement that with allocations and appropriations from the state. That becomes very difficult for all the reasons that you know. There are limited resources there, and it does put pressure on the universities. So what do we see? And it's what you see in the business world. We've seen in the last 5 years or so, schools are closing, schools are merging. We're seeing large universities finding ways to expand their revenue sources. One of the leaders in this in Indiana is Mitch Daniels, a former budget director and now the president at Purdue University. He bought Kaplan, an online school, in part to diversify their revenue streams. So he's running Purdue like a businessman would run a business, saying, I have a static pool. I'm under a lot of pressure on the revenue side. What do I need to do? I need to find a way to expand my revenue base. So we're seeing a lot of exciting things. I get really charged up about this, Bob, because I think finally, after decades and decades of education, higher education, finance, and funding being static, we're starting to see a lot of really interesting, maneuvers or reactions by schools, the end result of which, by the way, should be better education for students over time at a better cost.
You know, one final thought on that. Of course, I love numbers. I would love to be that person who tries to figure out that balance. I mean, that's just got to be such an interesting process to go through when you start to looking at all the different revenue streams, the costs, and everything that goes into it.
Yeah, every university has an enrollment manager, and that enrollment manager works with the business office to maximize net tuition revenue and everything we've been talking about. You're precisely right. It's a fascinating job, and now these big universities, they have a really interesting sort of free world view of what they can do to attract students. You know, your question earlier, though, there were two or three things I wanted to say, and you asked about the schools that did not want to be in the front end of the tuition of capping. Actually, those schools that I talked about before on the bubble and others and large universities, we've seen tuition freezes over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, or a tuition guarantee where they'll say to a freshman, if you come here, we will not increase your tuition for the period of time that you're here. Whatever your starting price will be will be the price that you'll have at the end. Some have these innovative sibling plans. If there's more than one student, they'll offer a discount to that family. So, again, there's an awful lot going on there, and the schools are feeling the pinch, and they're feeling the pinch because enrollments are going to be down. When you look ahead at the way the enrollment trends are going to go in the next 5 to 10 years, there will be a lot of competition for these students coming out of high school.
We have less than a minute left, John. I just want to mention your website, because you've had a lot of changes to that, offering a lot of free resources. Talk about that real quick.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. Yeah, we're excited in part because of the conversations that we have. If your listeners go to mycollegecorner.com, and they'll find an EFC calculator, so that's your expected family contribution calculator, which is very critical to get an idea early on in the financial aid process. There's a scholarship search engine there for free, a college search engine for free. We have some articles up as well, and there's a contact us button there. So as you always say, you know, we love talking to families about this. So if they have any questions, either come through Maven or come through mycollegecorner.com. But we really enjoy that interaction with families.
Well, great information, John, and always a pleasure to talk to you and have you as a resource. I know that it's helpful to a lot of people.
Thank you, Bob.
This is Bob Brooks, and you are listening to the Prudent Money Radio Show. Once again, mycollegecorner.com. And if you want, if you have a question for John, all you got to do is go to my website and send an instant message to him. It's very easy. He's available, makes himself available to answer your questions. That's all at prudentmoney.com. This is Bob Brooks. We are all out of time. Until we do meet again next time, keep the faith. Have a great rest of the day.
That's all the time we have for today. Questions or comments for Bob, or to find out more great information like what you've just heard, visit www.prudentmoney.com. Be sure to join Bob Brooks again for the next edition of Prudent Money.